Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and we search the internet for interesting books, and when we find a really interesting one, like we found today, we interview the author, and today we'll be talking with Edward Skidelsky about his book, How Much is Enough? Money and the Good Life. Edward, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Marshall.
Perhaps you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a academic philosopher at the University of Exeter in the west of England. I've been here about 4 years. Before that, I've worked variously as a journalist for NGOs, for publishing companies. So I have a foot in the world of both academia and journalism. I'm a moral philosopher, primarily. I'm particularly interested in ancient philosophy. And I try and apply some ideas from ancient philosophy to the modern world.
Well, you've done that in this book, as I know. People who've read it know that. How did you come to write How Much is Enough, Money and the Good Life?
Well, it's a joint authored book. I wrote it together with my father, Robert Skidelsky, who's a historian and economist, a great expert on John Maynard Keynes. And I suppose there was a sort of convergence of interests. My dad was sparked off by a little essay written by Keynes called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. This was a little thing he wrote in 1929, speculating about economic prospects in 100 years' time. I got interested in the subject really through looking at Aristotle and what Aristotle has to say about money. And we realized there was a lot of overlap. And then, of course, there was the economic crash of 2008, which kind of got everyone thinking about money. So all these things came together, and we decided to write the book. It was actually my father who proposed it to me and came up with the title, How Much is Enough?
And a good title it is, yeah.
Well, we thought of the title before we thought of the book. It was a title looking for a book.
That's excellent. Usually happens the other way around, I can tell you from experience. But yeah. So before we go on to talk about the book, you just mentioned that you did a little study or some research on what Aristotle says about money. What does Aristotle say about money? I didn't know Aristotle said anything about money.
Well, he makes a very simple and obvious point, which many other people have made, which is that money is basically a tool for getting things you want. It's not of any value in itself. I mean, you can't eat it, you can't drink it. And he tells the story of King Midas to make this point clear. King Midas was granted the power to turn anything he wanted into gold, and he thought this was great. He went around turning stuff into gold. And then after a while, he realized that, whenever he put any food to his mouth, it turned to gold. So he was on the brink of starving to death. So money is basically an instrument. It's for something. And then the question is, well, what's it for? And the answer that Aristotle gives is it's to enable you to lead a good life, to provide the material conditions for living well. Of course, money itself can't give you a good life. You need to have certain qualities of character as well, but you also need certain material prerequisites. And that you know, is basically the idea behind our book, that money is a means to an end. The end is the good life. And now in the Western world, we have enough collectively to lead a good life. So it's silly to go on striving for more. That's kind of madness.
I didn't know Midas was from Aristotle or was in Aristotle. Yeah, I'm not really an Aristotle scholar, so it doesn't surprise me. I don't know that. So let's talk about Keynes a little bit. Keynes, very popular on this side of the Atlantic among some people. In this particular essay, though, you say he was wrong about something. So could you talk a little bit about that essay and how he was wrong?
Yeah, well, Keynes, he asked, what are the economic prospects for our grandchildren? So the people will be living in 100 years hence, i.e. about 2030. And he makes two predictions, one about incomes, the other about working hours. About incomes, he says, we'll be roughly 4 to 8 times as rich as we are now. And that has turned out to be strikingly accurate. We're almost 4 times as rich. So presumably by 2030, we'll be slightly over 4 times as rich. So, you know, within the limits of his estimate. But he then draws the conclusion that once we reach this stage, we will have enough to satisfy all our material wants. And so we'll stop working, basically, or we'll start working much less. He reckons only 3 hours a day or 15 hours a week, enough to satisfy the old Adam in us, he says. Now, that clearly has not happened and doesn't look likely to happen in the next 20 years. Europeans work on average about 40 hours a week, Americans slightly more, so nowhere near 15 hours a week. And it's not going down either. In fact, it may be going up slightly. So the question we asked ourselves is, why did Keynes, get it so right about incomes, yet so wrong about working hours? And we suggest a number of possible reasons for this. The basic one, I suppose, is that he misunderstood the nature of human wants. He thought that humans have a finite number of wants, and that once those wants are fully satisfied, they'll have enough and they'll stop working. But what's now become clear is that human wants are infinitely expandable because they're relative. We want things not just because we need them in some absolute sense, but because other people have them or other people don't have them. So we're always comparing ourselves with others. And of course, this process is greatly encouraged by producers who are always trying to create new markets for their products. It's not just a natural process. It's one that's encouraged by the logic of capitalism. So despite the fact that we now have enough to lead a good life, we continually strive after more and more, and that means we have to keep on working hard. And of course, this ties together with Aristotle, not entirely coincidentally, because Keynes, of course, knew his Aristotle and was very influenced by him. So that's the convergence between the two strands of thought.
So we have to talk a little bit about why we continue to work so much. This actually occurred to me when I was about 18 years old. I really did. I walked my parents and people that I knew working all the time, and I knew how much money they had relative to me, and it was a lot more. And I actually remember asking my mother when she was a teacher, high school teacher, junior high school teacher, I said, if you would just give me as much money as you make in 3 days, I could live for a month. And she's like, but I'm not going to give you that money. So why, there are lots of reasons why we, in the hierarchy of I think economists call this the hierarchy of preferences, that empty time, that is free time, does not seem to rank very high. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. And this was the question asked by a Swedish economist called Staffan Linde in the 1970s. He wrote a book called The Harried Leisure Class, asking why it is that basically Keynes's prophecy hadn't come true. And he proposed an interesting answer, which is that free time is actually costly time. It costs money, i.e. the money that you could have made while working. if you had been working. So, you know, every sort of hour I spend, you know, lying on the beach, I could have made whatever, £50. Mm-hmm. So it's expensive. And of course, the cost goes up the more you earn. So the higher your salary, the more it costs you not to work. And that means that in order to make it worthwhile not to work, you have to make leisure as, as full of utility as the work you've lost would have been. Mm-hmm. And that means you have to sort of pack it with gadgets, basically. You know, so it's not enough just to lie on the beach. You have to, you know, go scuba diving or, you know, whatever, you know, and that costs money. And that, of course, means that you have to work. So we're kind of trapped in this sort of work consumption treadmill. This point was made by one of the critics of our books, Richard Posner, writing for the New York Times. He said, if the Skidelsky's proposals were realized, if we all worked only 3 hours a day, we'd have all this leisure time, but we wouldn't know what to do with it because we'd all be really poor. You know, we wouldn't have the money to afford all these, you know, cool things that we need to make good use of our leisure time. Mm-hmm. So we'd just, we'd just sit around getting drunk or fighting or sleeping. Mm-hmm. Now, I just think this portrays a really pessimistic view of human nature. Mm-hmm. I think, actually, if we did have that much leisure time, we'd find ways of making creative use of it. The way we use our leisure at the moment is not a good indication of how we'd use it if we had much more leisure. Mm-hmm. Because at the moment, basically, people only have a few hours of leisure each day after work, and they're too tired to do anything. So they just flop out in front of the TV. But if we had a lot more leisure, I have no doubt that we'd find ways of making creative use of it that didn't involve a lot of money. Reading, for instance, that's pretty cheap. Games, making music, amateur theatricals. If you read the novels of Jane Austen, you find her characters are always doing things like this. And now those kind of things will be affordable to most people, mm-hmm. even if they only work 3 hours a day. So I'm more optimistic than Posner.
Yeah, I can think of one class of people who definitely have an extraordinarily high preference for leisure time and are willing to sacrifice almost everything for it, and that is drug addicts. By another connection, I know some of them. I'm sort of involved in helping people who are addicted to various substances, and those people will not work. They will do drugs instead until they have no money.
Yeah.
And then they will basically go to work to get more money for drugs. But I don't think that's probably a very good case.
That's not a good model.
No, not a good model at all.
I think it's mainly the case that, you know, people lose their jobs and then become drug addicts. So the drugs fill the empty space.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting question for another show. I can't agree with you there but it is an interesting topic why people become addicted to substances like this. But let's go back to the question of why we don't prefer leisure time. One, it seems obvious reason to me, is that people really enjoy their work.
Well, yeah, we looked into this.
Let me just say, if you ask Americans, and I don't remember the statistics, but if you ask Americans if they're satisfied, and it all depends on, of course, how you ask the question, but if they like their work or they're satisfied by the work, something like 90% of Americans say yes.
Well, yes. But of course, I think particularly in America, there are strong incentives to say yes. Mm-hmm. People don't want to seem like losers.
We smile.
How reliable those statistics are. But even if it's true that people, like their work, it doesn't mean that they want to work as many hours as they do. I mean, we're not proposing, you know, the complete abolition of work by any means. I think work is a source of meaning for many people, but they could get that meaning working much less.
Mm-hmm.
3, 4, 5 hours a day. You don't have to work 8 or 9 hours a day to get that,
mm-hmm.
to get that sense of meaning from your job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I quite agree with you there. And I always think about these boundary cases, that these sort of extreme cases. So drug addicts are on one end of the scale. They don't want to work at all. They just want to do drugs all the time. Then on the other end of the scale are these people that make millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I always think to myself, I put on my economist hat, and I'm like, What is the marginal utility of another $1 million to somebody who has $500 million? It's zero. I mean, it's functionally zero. Yeah. It can't add anything.
But of course, it's comparative. I mean, they're comparing themselves with other people who are earning similar sums. So, although in itself it's zero, it's I think it, was it who was it who said money? Money is just a way of keeping score. I think once you get to the sort of top end, that becomes pretty important.
I mean, I often think, when I think about this in my own life, I in your scenario would be very happy with the six conditions upon which one could live the good life. But I am a kind of a bookish person that likes I also like sports, and I can occupy my free time very easily with things that do not involve making money. But I think it's peculiar to scholars. Do you think that's true? I mean, I know a lot of people that would just quit their teaching gig.
I think it was. I mean, 100 years ago, it was. The assumption was if you made a bit of money, you stopped working. Mm-hmm. That's what rich people did.
Mm-hmm. No, that's
perhaps not so much in America, but certainly in England and in Europe. Once you made enough to live as a gentleman, as the phrase went. You did precisely that. You bought a house in the country. You went hunting. Maybe you spent a day in the office just to sort of manage your estate. But basically, you stopped working. And I think Keynes assumed that would be the pattern for most people in the future as they, as we all became richer, we'd all start living like gentlemen. So I think the work ethic has been kind of instilled into us by capitalism. I don't think it's natural.
Yeah, no, it starts very early too, and I think in order to realize some of the plans that you lay out in the book, it would have to start very early because, I have young kids and I'm already teaching them about money and I'm already saying to them, if you want to play video games, you have to buy them and you have to have a job. And my son is very acquisitive. He wants many toys. He doesn't want one toy, and he goes to the store and he sees all the toys, and I don't really know. He's bombarded with images of wealth, and he equates, and this is the kind of interesting, gets right to the crux of it, and it gets to a chapter in your book. He equates more stuff with happiness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, about children first of all. I mean, I think that's true. A lot of advertising is subliminally directed at children now, and I think one in Sweden, I think it is. There's a ban on advertising that's directed at children, which I think is a very good idea, and we'd like to see that extended. About happiness, a lot of critics of growth appeal to the notion of happiness. They point out that even as GDP has gone up in most Western countries, happiness has remained flat, and they draw the obvious conclusion that we should stop trying to expand GDP and start thinking about GDH, gross domestic happiness, instead. We're sympathetic with the conclusion, obviously, but we think the argument is a bad one for two reasons, really. First of all, we think that it doesn't make much sense to measure happiness. There are all kinds of methodological problems with the way these happiness surveys are constructed. Which we can talk about if you like. But I suppose the more fundamental problem is that we don't think happiness is good in and of itself, because it all depends on what you're happy about. I mean, happiness is what philosophers call an intentional attitude. I mean, you're not just happy, you're happy about something or other. And the value of your happiness depends very much on what you're happy about. So, there are some things that it's best not to be happy about. In some situations, it's better to be unhappy. Mm-hmm. If you're in a war zone or in a situation of great injustice or oppression, you shouldn't be happy. You should be angry, outraged. Mm-hmm. To make happiness, in and of itself, independent of its objects, the goal of economic policy is really it's a recipe for Brave New World. So we don't appeal to happiness.
Yeah, actually, I would like to talk a little bit about those happiness surveys. One reason, well, there are two reasons. One is that I've always been incredibly skeptical of them, like you. And the other is that they're extraordinarily popular in American academic circles now. There's like happiness studies.
Yeah.
There's really like people are building huge careers on this measuring happiness thing. Could you talk a little bit about the what you perceive as the problems with these surveys?
Well, I think there are all kinds of problems, which we discuss in the book. I suppose, I mean, one is, I mean, you know, a lot of happiness surveys, you know, use scales, 1 to 5, 1 to 10. But it's never explained to participants what these numbers mean. You know, is this meant to be an average? You know, does 5 represent average happiness? If so, what's the population? Are you comparing yourself to people in your own country or in the world? Mm-hmm. Or is this meant to be some sort of absolute scale? If so, what do the boundaries represent? You know, it's 10 sort of, you know, total bliss, whatever that is. I just wouldn't know what to say if I was asked how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10. It's a meaningless question. So that's one problem. Then there's a problem of translation. If you're comparing happiness between countries, you know, you've got to make sure that the words you use mean the same thing. But in fact, they don't. Happiness doesn't have exact synonyms in other languages. Happiness is generally a lighter term. It's one that, you know, we use, you know, English speakers use quite readily. Whereas, the Russian word "счастье," for instance, which is a much more serious term. I mean, you wouldn't say that you were счастье unless, you know, you really were. You know, which is perhaps the reason that Russians don't come out so well in these surveys. So that's another problem. There's the problem of, you know, are people reliable judges of their own happiness? I'm not sure they are. I think, there are all kinds of pressures on us to pretend to be happier than we really are, perhaps even to think that we're happier than we really are, or in other countries to pretend to be less happy than we are, because, you know, you don't want to tempt the gods. I think it's a kind of pseudoscience, actually, measuring happiness.
I mean, I quite agree with you there. I've never really understood exactly what they're after here, because I know when I look into my own heart, I guess I would say by metaphor, and say, how happy are you? I ask the same questions that you ask, relative to whom? You know, to the guy that just lost his leg? Well, probably more. You know, to the guy who, just on the team that won the World Cup, probably less. What's the metric here? I mean, can I count it? Or, you know, when I just wake up, I tend to be happier than midday when I'm, you know, don't feel very good because I'm tired. It's a very elusive thing. And then, you know, having spent time abroad, I can also tell you that what you say about, particularly Russians, because I've spent a lot of time there, you're definitely right about that. It's just not one of these things that can be easily translated. So what do we measure if we have to measure anything? Can we measure anything in terms of like well-being or contentment or spiritual fitness or what do you call it? Is there anything we can?
Yeah. Well, I don't think we can measure these things directly, because, they're just not, you know, they're qualities, they're not quantities. But I think, I mean, you can measure things, you know, that are correlated with them or, proxies. So, you know, for instance, if you're interested in health, you can look at life expectancy, obesity, alcoholism, incidences of, you know, disease. These figures tell you something. Even with health, I think it's difficult because you've got to make judgments about quality of life as well. I don't think life expectancy on its own is a particularly good measure because, you know, you can keep people alive for a long time in a state of pretty debilitating sickness. So you're always going to have to, you know, make a judgment. Statistics are useful. I mean, we're not dismissing statistics. We're just saying they have to be handled with care. And we don't think there's some general measure of well-being. We don't think you can, aggregate all these statistics and come up with a sort of universal metric. We think that would be a mistake. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to take them all individually and then sort of, you know, decide which one you think is more important. you know, that's what that's what politics is all about.
Right. So that, but that's bad news for both happiness studies and for gross domestic happiness.
It's treating a political problem as though it's a technical bureaucratic problem.
Now, let me go back to the world of work again. And this is a particularly interesting case. And I actually think, funnily enough, Marxists have something to say about it. And that is that why do we work 40 hours a week? I mean, part of it has to do with what employers require of us, doesn't it?
That's certainly part of it. It's, you know, there are imbalances of power in the labor market. That's been made much worse by the decline of the unions in the last 30 years or so. Yeah, I mean, most people, even if they wanted to work less, they just they wouldn't find anyone to take them on for less.
This is what I'm getting after. I kind of I'm old enough that I grew up with a bunch of hippies, and you know, we talked about dropping out and taking part time jobs and living in Montana in a hut and all this other stuff. And I don't know what else we were going to do, but opening bookstores, I suppose. But it just isn't very easy to work 15 hours a week and have a decent middle class life.
Yeah. You know, employers aren't sympathetic to the idea. In fact, I mean, many employers, they like you to put in extra hours as a sort of sign of your devotion to the company, to the brand. You know, I mean, a lot of friends of mine, you know, work overtime, unpaid overtime, in fact, just because they, you know, they're worried that unless they, you know, show that 110% commitment, they're going to lose their jobs.
Yeah, I remember hearing a Buddhist talk about this, and he said that you can kind of think of capitalism as we currently have it configured. You know, in many ways, it's very good. It has provided us with a lot of stuff, but it's a competitive game in which you will always lose. You can never win it. And so he said you should opt for other kind of measures of what he kind of generically called well-being, that you're going to lose this game. You're never going to have the most money. You're never going to be king of the world. You know, the next bobble is not going to make you happy. So you should sort of opt out and choose another. And he thought of sort of spiritual fitness or enlightenment or something like this. Yeah. So, I mean, and I quite agree with him. I mean, having lived in competitive capitalism for a long time, I am losing. And I think I will lose. And eventually I'll die. So I'll definitely lose that one. So, I mean, it seems to me it suggests thinking about our world in this way suggests a kind of stoicism, doesn't it? To hearken back to some ancient philosophers.
Yeah, I mean, we draw our inspiration not so much from the Stoics, more from Aristotle, also the Epicureans, who had a nice philosophy, I think. I mean, they said that you know, pleasure really is achieved not so much by realizing all your many desires, but by reducing your desires to a minimum. And that makes it easier to satisfy the few desires that you have left. Whereas the tendency of capitalism is exactly the opposite. It's to endlessly expand our desires. So, you know, you satisfy one lot and then a whole new lot suddenly grow up, like, you know, like the heads of the Hydra. And then you have to satisfy them and so on. So, yeah, as you say, you're always going to lose. So what we're really advocating is a sort of reduction of desire, or at least material desires, maybe not other kinds of desire.
Yeah, and I think this is what the Buddhists, obviously there are lots of kinds of Buddhists, but this is what this particular Buddhist would say. And, you know, they begin by saying that, you know, you're suffering, and the reason you're suffering is because you desire things, and these things can never satisfy you. And then they have another program that, you know, you might be able to get satisfied with, but it doesn't involve the acquisition of a new Mercedes-Benz and all that is entailed there. It doesn't involve really a lot of worldly activity at all, outside helping people. But again, it seems to me that we would have to socialize our children in just an entirely different way. And one of the things that, I mean, I'll just make an observation, that it seems to me the less religious we become, the more materialistic we become. I know that's very simplistic, but if you're not going to play the game of religion where you try to, you know, reach heaven or reach spiritual enlightenment, you're going to play any game that's available. And the game that's available is competitive capitalism.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, one of the central messages of Christianity was you know, love of money is the root of all evil. The sins of avarice, usury, greed, I mean, these were endlessly emphasized by you know, early Christian and medieval theologians. much more, in fact, than, you know, the sexual vices. Now, I think, I mean, religion has become a much weaker force in our society, or it's become infected by the spirit of capitalism, particularly in America, I think. You know, Christians aren't very heavy on greed or avarice anymore.
No, not really.
They're much heavier on sex outside marriage. Yeah, that's become the main focus of Christian morality, which is a big mistake. I mean, it's Jesus said hardly anything about sex. He said an awful lot about money.
Now, you talk a lot in the book about, and you propose sort of conditions that might make living the good life possible. Let's first talk about the conditions, and let's talk about what the good life might be. So, what are the conditions that are necessary in order to live the good life?
Well, if we're speaking about material conditions, I mean, we need a certain level of wealth. I don't think it's possible to live a good life in conditions of absolute poverty. So, you need enough money to buy yourself, food, enough food to live, and enough medicine to lead a reasonable span of life. To live in a house or flat, which gives you some privacy. To have a bit of leisure, so you're not working all day. You have time to rest, to enjoy leisure activities, friendship. Money is certainly an essential prerequisite, but it's nothing more than that. Money won't get you a good life itself. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient.
But it seems to me you also need, and this is precisely what we're lacking, is a kind of attitude or pitch toward life that says enough is enough.
And
it seems to me, except for a very few people, and actually I know some of them, they're monks, it's just not available to most people.
If you
look, for example, what people teach in philosophy departments, it certainly isn't how to live the good life.
That's true. I try with my students. It depends. I mean, I think it depends what sort of sector you're looking at. I think among academics, money is probably not the most important thing. But then there are other forms of insatiability.
That would be status.
Status, number of publications. Right. I mean, these other things have the same kind of function as money. So, we're all kind of on one treadmill or another. It's hard to resist that.
Let's say resilience. Let's say then you have these things that at a bare minimum, enable you to live the good life. What does the good life entail, and how do you know whether you're living it?
Well, we talk about basic goods. The number seven doesn't need to be taken that seriously. Other people have come up with slightly more, slightly less. We call the seven basic goods health, respect, personality, security, harmony with nature, friendship, and leisure. And how did we come up with these? Well, we thought about what the good life requires. We read widely, thinkers not just in the West but in China and India too, and we found there is quite a lot of overlap between what these people have said. There is a kind of consensus on this. The seven basic goods are our effort to summarize this consensus.
And if you have them, are you living the good life?
Yeah. It's a threshold. So it's, this is a minimum. Obviously, people will pursue more specific goals. Intellectual excellence, becoming very good at a musical instrument. These may be important to individuals, but the seven basic goods are just a sort of basic minimum that anyone needs in order to lead a good life.
Right. Well, I quite agree with what you say there, that this is a condition which is necessary for you to go forward and live the good life. It's just the thing I'm not understanding is, once you have those things, what do you do?
Well, I mean, they're not things that you just have and then sit on. I mean, they're things that require maintenance. Mm-hmm. So, like friendship, for instance, you have to maintain friendships, and that requires activity. Mm-hmm. Leisure. I mean, you have to fill your leisure with activity. I mean, leisure is our name for a form of activity. It's not just time off work.
Yes, I see.
Mm-hmm. It's doing things for its own sake. So, I mean, it's not a passive ideal. It's an active one.
Mm-hmm. So you would go to the gym. You know, try to stay fit. You would work a certain amount, so you had a certain amount to eat. You would maintain your friendships and these kinds of things.
Yeah.
I see just what you mean. So I guess one thing that occurs to me is that, and you mentioned this in the book as a kind of matter of what is it called? Evolutionary psychology. That humans seem to be really competitive. They are just naturally so. And that they seem to be acquisitive, and that they are naturally so. Perhaps not as much as they are in contemporary capitalism, but they will tend to want more, and they will tend to compete with their fellows outside in any given social system. It seems to me that some element of it has to be a program or practice that dampens that down, that somehow suppresses those things, or you will find yourself careening toward what is essentially capitalism again.
Yeah, I think the competitive instinct is innate. I think it takes various different forms in different societies. In some societies, people compete over hunting trophies or women. In the modern West, we compete over money mainly. It is malleable. It shouldn't be treated just as a biological given. It's something we can moderate or redirect in various ways that we consider beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to see a more equal society in which there's some inequality of income, but much less than we have now. So you'll still have competition, but the competition would just not be as fierce.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this would be kind of a capitalism turned down from 11 to 4. So to speak.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, I see.
Which is what you have in a lot of European countries.
Yeah, I see just what you mean. I find myself thinking about religion, because the people who I know who have successfully done this, who have taken themselves out of this rat race, so to say, to call it a rat race, have all been people who are searching for some kind of spiritual fitness, that they have been the most successful at realizing the kind of thing that you're talking about. Yet what role does religion play in exits from the rat race?
We think it's important as a source of individual inspiration, but our book is not really a self-help book for individuals. It's really a book about politics.
Mm-hmm.
So we think the exit from the rat race has to be brought about at a political level. There's only so much individuals can do on their own to change society. For the last 100 years or so, we've had sort of dropouts, groups of hippies, utopians,
right.
But they've all been marginal. They haven't changed the fabric of society as a whole. To do that, we need to actually change the law.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we end the book with some political proposals.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about those. What laws should be changed? Make you king of the world, and what do you do?
Well, I think one of the easiest things you could do is put various restrictions on advertising. In fact, there are already restrictions on advertising in most countries on particular products. So it'd just be a question of extending them, and maybe prohibiting advertising in various places. Michael Sandel has written a very good book, What Money Can't Buy, in which he talks about the encroachment of advertising into schools, hospitals, even police stations, sporting events. So you're literally bombarded with adverts wherever you look. That process could be halted just by making it illegal to put up adverts everywhere. So I mean, that's one thing you could easily do.
Can we stop there for just 1 second? Because that reminds me of reading Plato, of all people, Plato. Because Plato says that actually, the things that you hear and see and especially read can hurt you.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't believe that today, do we? I mean, most people, it's in the Constitution of the United States. We say, you know, freedom of speech. I mean, immediately someone would say, we can't ban advertising there because that would be a violation of freedom of speech. Besides, sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can never hurt you. I mean, I think that's false.
But yeah, I think it's definitely false.
I think it's totally false, but you have to reach a certain stage of enlightenment and understanding in order to get to the stage where you can say, well, actually, the things you do read and see and do, they hurt you. They can hurt you.
Yeah, and anyway, I mean, until, I think, was it the 1960s, America had very strict, you know, laws on pornography, you know, defined as matter tending to deprave and corrupt, I think it was. So, yeah, that clearly wasn't considered unconstitutional. So, you know, I think it could be done. Yeah, a lot of advertising tends to deprave and corrupt.
Yeah, it just seems to me, I guess it seems to me as a matter of practical politics that almost every time someone has come up against freedom of speech in the United States, at least, they've lost. And that's how we got, pornography is an interesting case because, it would seem to me there are pretty good reasons to limit pornography, but they've just been completely cast aside now. There's nothing, outside kiddie porn, everything goes.
Yeah.
And it does that by the smartest people in the United States, the people who know the law the best, they decided that. So, I mean, the weight of opinion is, in fact, quite against Plato, that it is sticks and stones.
Yeah. I think, and the problem is once, you know, it's not as if you can look away, particularly advertising on TV. I mean, if it breaks up a TV program, you have to watch it.
Yeah, actually, Plato talks about that, too, I remember. He sees, he has somebody go by this public execution. And I don't remember exactly what happened. And he has to look, and then he's really upset with himself. Yeah, right? You remember this?
Yes, he's tempted. His I think that's the thing. You know, we're weak, and we actually need to be protected from ourselves sometimes, and we want to be protected from ourselves. That's one of the functions of law. Mm-hmm. So we are openly paternalist on this. Mm-hmm. We don't think that people's wants should be allowed free expression. We think they should be molded and constrained by some notion of good.
Right. I mean, I quite agree with you. I just think that in the contemporary American climate that it's impossible. But maybe in the European, it's impossible in the United States. There'd be just no way. So anyway, what's something else other than limiting advertising that we could do?
Well, we have various other proposals. One of them is for a minimum basic income, an unconditional basic income. So this would be an income paid to all citizens over the age of 18, regardless of whether they're in work or out of work or anything else. Mm-hmm. It would probably be quite small at first, but then rising over time as societies become richer. And the idea would just be to give people some flexibility over their hours and conditions of work. To make it a bit easier for them to work part-time if they wanted or in a, you know, more fulfilling but less well-paid job.
Mm-hmm. And where would this money come from?
From taxes. Mm-hmm. Some economists have worked it out and they say it wouldn't actually be impossible in wealthy societies.
Yeah, I've read this as well, yeah.
I'm not an economist, so I can't comment on that, but my father has assured me that it would be possible. In fact, something like this was actually started in the UK by the last government, a so-called baby bond scheme. Mm-hmm. So this was a lump sum that would be, you know, invested at birth. And, mm-hmm. you know, by the age of 18, it would be a few thousand pounds. So it was just a start. It could have been built on, but it was scrapped by the current government.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So baby bonds and anything else? So no advertising, limitations to advertising, some baby bonds, which is that's a good term for it. Anything else?
Yes. Another proposal is for a tax on consumption rather than on incomes. So, you know, rather than taxing people on how much money they've earned in the year, you'd tax them on how much they'd spent. So you'd subtract savings from earnings. And this would be progressive, so, you know, it would really sort of kick in, you know, once you're spending over, I don't know, $60,000, $80,000 a year.
Isn't that what the VAT is? Isn't it a consumption tax? Maybe I'm confused.
No, this. I mean, VAT is a tax on transactions, whereas this would be a tax on individuals.
Okay.
So you'd pay it like an income tax you know, at the end of your tax year. But it would only be a tax on what you'd spent, not on what you'd saved.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be progressive, unlike VAT. And the idea would be two effects. One would it would deter luxury consumption, and the other is it would encourage saving for old age.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in discouraging luxury consumption, it would have knock-on effects all the way down the chain, because a lot of consumption is emulative. You know, people are trying to keep up with those a little bit richer than themselves. So it should have a depressing effect on consumption all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
The economist Robert Frank has written quite a bit on this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, draw on him.
Mm-hmm. So others?
Other schemes?
Mm-hmm.
What else do we say?
That's plenty for now. That's a heck of a lot.
I mean, these are just ideas. I mean, mm-hmm. We're not sort of writing a party manifesto. We're just sort of throwing some ideas into the arena. But the main thing is that governments have to decide that, this is something they want to tackle, and that they have the power and the right to do so.
Right. But I guess one thing that occurs to me is, since these governments are democratic, the first thing to do would be to convince people.
Sure.
That
sure.
In fact, they need to return, and here I'll put words in your mouth, but I just want to be interested to hear what you say about to return to a life that's measured by virtue rather than measured by income.
Yeah, I mean, these are, we're just putting ideas into the public sphere, and hopefully enough people will find them attractive that they'll try and translate them into policy. These are proposed in a democratic spirit. We're mm-hmm. not kind of speaking to some technocratic elite here.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems to me that the place where this is, again, I hate to keep going back to religion, but the place where this is actually discussed, at least in my experience, is in fact in religious contexts, where somebody will say, somebody who is a leader in a community will say, you aren't actually living like Christ, because Christ said X, Y, and Z, and you're doing A, B, and C. And, Christ suggests a kind of life of virtue, and the virtues are measured in this way. And I don't see any politician speaking that language at all. I mean, I just don't see any politician doing it. But I do see spiritual leaders doing it.
Yeah. Although, I mean, my impression is that, many of the churches in America are fully supportive of free market capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they see that as a uniquely Christian way of life. And they see state interference as socialist and therefore unchristian.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right there?
Well, I have a personal theory.
That's my impression.
I have a theory about this that will be completely unpopular among almost everybody, and that is this attitude is a result of the doctrine of religious toleration. And basically what the state says when it tolerates every religion is that all religions are the same and they don't really matter. And Americans caught on to that pretty fast, that religion just wasn't very important in their lives. And so that game was taken away, and they started to play another game, and that's the game of acquisitiveness. There are isolated communities of people that take their spiritual lives very seriously. I've seen them, but my own feeling is that most religion in America and in the West is has been adapted to capitalism rather than the other way around. And that is because the most important people in these states said religion just doesn't matter very much. Pick whatever one you want.
They're
just all the same. become a Wiccan. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You may be an Orthodox Jew. It doesn't matter. Be a Protestant. It doesn't matter. But it does matter. And people don't realize that anymore. So, it's only my opinion that you go to American churches today and they do talk about virtue and things like this, but the doctrine is really be nice.
Yeah.
That's what they learn. Be nice.
What's happened is, religion's been confined to the private sphere.
Yeah.
And this really started to happen in the late 17th, 18th century. Because before then, religion claimed to regulate the whole of life.
Yeah, so that's right.
What you did in work and politics, as well as what you did at home. And And then what happened? I mean, we discussed this in the book. Economics was liberated from religion.
That's right.
Because people realized that actually, if you give people a license to make money, provided they don't break the law, the effects will be beneficial all around. So economics was sort of liberated from the religious embrace, if you like, and religion was really left with sex and the family. And that's where it stayed pretty much ever since. In fact, now even sex and the family are sort of are seen as sort of have been liberated from religion. So,
I mean, they're being assimilated to this most general doctrine that you get to pursue happiness on your own and nobody gets to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
And that your decisions will be the best ones for you. And I think it's the last part that is completely false, because I quite agree with you. People do not often know what is good for them. Ask a drug addict. They know after they've come clean, or at least they start to learn, that they know that their decisions have been bad ones and that they could have used regulation and they didn't have it. So they ended up in a very bad situation. So I'm not, again, I do know people that take their religious lives very seriously, that they have sort of spiritual programs they live by. They're very few. Mostly they just go to church on Sunday, or they don't go at all. And most Americans don't go to church at all. So,
well, they go much more than Europeans.
Yeah, well, they say, actually, it's funny because the statistics are interesting there. I just was doing some research on that. 40% of them say they go every week to church. 40% of Americans say they go every week. But then actually when you count people in the pews, it's 20%. So what that suggests is that people feel guilty about not going to church.
Yes.
that's the most you can say about that. And I mean, the fact of the matter is they're not getting anything out of it. And that's really the problem, is that, this brings me back to philosophy departments. I love philosophy. I did analytic philosophy as an undergraduate, and I still read it. And but it just strikes me that the things that should be thought in philosophy departments really should all ask one question: why are we living the way we're living? And nobody asks that question anymore. Maybe you do in your classes.
Well, I think philosophers are, they're worried about being seen as preachers, or as having some special wisdom to offer. That seems somehow, not very academically respectable.
Right. But analytic philosophy is not the examined life. It's an examination of language.
Yeah, it's the analysis of concepts.
Yeah.
The way I try to teach philosophy, or moral philosophy at any rate, it does, treat the question of how best to live as central. I think that is the central question in moral philosophy.
Mm-hmm. So would you encourage, say you had this great student that really understood everything you were saying and understood the quixotic nature of the pursuit of things and that things would make you happy and realized that they were making lots of decisions that were sort of spiritually bankrupting them and that they weren't acting in a virtuous way, and said, would you suggest to such a person that they should drop out of life, sort of, just go live as a, I don't know how they would live, but
it's hard in a modern university, as you have hundreds of students every year, so it's you're giving big lectures or classes, so it's you don't often get to form that kind of personal relationship with your students.
I mean, the only reason I mention this is that I think I said in the pre-interview, I'm sort of at a stage in my own life when I have competed, and sometimes I've won and sometimes I've lost, and sometimes it's been satisfying and sometimes not. And I'm more and more disenchanted with the game itself. And I sort of want to remove myself, but I it's very hard to remove yourself. Everybody's expectations is that you will continue. And if you don't continue, people think you're insane. they just think you're nuts, because everybody's in the game. And so they don't realize they're in the game, because the game has been naturalized, if you see what I mean, in a technical sense. It's like, this is the way life is. There is no other way. A lot of Americans will say that.
I think you just have to have a lot of self-confidence and conviction, I suppose, that this is how you want to live, and you're not going to be bullied into living any other way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very hard.
Yeah, I mean, the thing in my own life, I can say that, and by my observations, that the really difficult thing is, I mean, the actual heavy lifting is not the realization that things won't buy you happiness. Pretty much everyone knows that. It's finding a way to explain that to people in a compelling way. And I've never found a way to do that.
Yes, well, that is the function of religion. That's what good preaching is about.
Right.
I don't think I've got the literary gifts for that. But
no, and I don't think people are prepared to hear it. And I think I'd be interested to hear from people who, I do know people who are religious, like I say, and take their spiritual lives very interesting. And I think they would read your book and say, yeah, this is exactly right. And that it is, I know what Buddhists would say. They'd say it is hopeless to try to change society. It's just hopeless. And the most you can possibly do is change yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes, I know that's the Buddhist view, but I'm a bit more engaged than that, I think.
Yeah, no, I can. And also Buddhism thoroughly practiced is really hard. I'm not a Buddhist, but I know people that are. It's really hard. So I can certainly understand why, it works for some people, but it takes a special kind of person to do it. So how has your book been received? I'd be interested to know that.
Well, it's done well. It's widely reviewed in England, mostly favorably, particularly in the left wing press. Some hostile reviews from the right wing press. In America, my sense is it sold okay, but a lot of Americans have said, "Look, this is just utopian."
Yeah.
We can never put these ideas into practice. Mm-hmm. As in fact you said. In Germany it's just come out and is doing extremely well. It's had very good publicity. Mm. It's selling very well. I think the Germans like that combination of philosophy and economics. Mm-hmm. It is the land of Marx after all. So I think it's done best in Germany of all the places it's come out.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll give it to people. I think I know what they'll say about it, and they'll say just what you said, that it's some sort of utopian something. And again, but part of that has to do with actually the legacy of the Cold War, where Americans fought something that they thought was utopian and tooth and nail, and actually it turned out to be the thing that they fought, which wasn't really communism, it was the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Maybe it was communism, I don't know. But this sort of, I guess I would call it knee-jerk reaction to proposals such as this, I think comes from
that experience. People forget just how quickly the consensus about what's possible and what's impossible can change. Because a lot of what we're proposing is actually what existed in the 1950s and 60s mm-hmm. and was dismantled in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. It's not that extremist, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not communism either. That's a mistake. Many
it's not communism.
This is communism. We're not opposed to private property. On the contrary, we think private property is absolutely crucial to liberty.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've taken up really a lot of your time. I want to ask our final question, which is, what are you working on now, Edward?
I've just written an essay on happiness and pleasure. Developing some of the ideas from How Much Is Enough. This is an academic essay. Mm-hmm. My longer term hope is to write a book on the language of the virtues, looking at how some key words like avarice, justice, charity, chastity have either dropped out of use or have changed their meaning in the last 300 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Looking at our modern moral language, that's my hope. I need to get some funding to do it, though.
Yeah, well, Edward, good luck on those books. We've been talking with Edward Skidelsky today, who co-authored a book with his father, Robert Skidelsky. The book is called How Much Is Enough? Money and the Good Life. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I want to thank everybody for listening, and I especially want to thank Edward for being on the show today.
Thank you, Marshall.
All right, thanks very much.